Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 15th of October. Earlier this month, it was announced that Gannett plans to buy Journal Media Group. It's the parent company of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They now own newspapers in Green Bay, the Fox Valley, other parts of Wisconsin. The president and CEO of Journal Media Group said, "This transaction marks a critical next step in the transformation of our industry as we build local media brands that matter at a time when operational scale is a competitive advantage. Both Journal Media Group and Gannett are guided by a vision of strengthening lives and communities and will be better stewards in our local markets by sharing ideas, content, and best practices among our new and larger family." We're going to look at consolidation in the U.S. newspaper industry. It's hard to imagine that there will not be a corporate headquarters in Milwaukee of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Used to be the Milwaukee Journal, used to be the Milwaukee Sentinel. I remember those days well. What will it do for the staff at the newspaper? Will there be significant cuts? And what about the coverage of local news, of state news, of city government, etc.? Will that suffer? What's happening to the newspaper industry? That's the question of this hour, and our guest is Robert McChesney. He's a professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, co-founder of the Media Reform Network Free Press, and author of many books about American media. His research interests include 20th century media history. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for Bob. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Robert McChesney, it's great to talk to you again. It's been a while. Hi.
It's great to be back, Kathleen.
Yeah. It's hard for me to imagine, having lived in this city for a long, long time, that there will no longer be a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. For me, I still can't believe there's not a Milwaukee Journal or a Milwaukee Sentinel. It's such a big change for a very large city.
It is indeed, and I moved to Wisconsin in the 80s, and those are really glory days in retrospect,
yeah,
compared to what we have now. And yeah, I think then if someone had told me this, we'd be having this conversation today, I would have thought that would be unthinkable. And but you know, the story isn't just Milwaukee. This is going on really in every other city in the country.
Mm-hmm.
This is a national, even an international story. And, these are broad tectonic shifts going on. Milwaukee is just sort of caught in the wave right now.
I guess the first thing I want to ask you is, what is going to happen to very important news coverage of City Hall, of state government, of all that goes on in this area, of crime in the city of Wisconsin, et cetera? Will there be coverage of those important issues?
Well, there's two things to keep in mind here. First of all, the coverage of local communities and local news everywhere in the country has diminished greatly in the last 20 years. The statistics are striking about the drop-off in the number of working reporters, paid working reporters, covering local communities, covering City Hall, covering state houses across the country. So we're at the end of really a grotesque process that began 20 or 25 years ago and really gathered steam in the last 10 years. The second point, though, I'd make, the way to answer that question, whether this Gannett purchase of the Journal Sentinel is going to affect the number of reporters. I mean, they've been very candid. I mean, you gave the press release, the public relations release they gave. And if you sort of decode the blarney there and you see what they're saying to investors, what their claim is that they can make this is all about making more money. And there are things they can do to make, in their view, digital publishing in the internet age, very profitable at the local level. And I think the experience we've seen, not just with Gannett, but with every media company that's trying to do this, is reducing labor cost is one of the first things you try to do. I mean, there's no place that has increased labor cost in the last 10 years in their effort to make a transition. And so I think the logical thing to expect is they're going to reduce labor costs. And the way they're going to do this I think their vision is by what they call scale. And this is the argument that as a company gets really big, so it has hundreds of newspapers, it will have need fewer reporters because the reporter's material can be spread across all the newspapers. And that's what they're going to – so you, the reader in Milwaukee won't notice there's that much less reporting in 2 years than there is today, but there will probably be fewer local reporters who cover just Milwaukee. There will be more material from the other Gannett papers.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about digital publishing, is that where everything will be, Bob, down the road?
Well, right now we're already seeing the effect of the internet has been devastating on the commercial model of journalism, and it has pretty much ruined it. I mean, it's ended it. And really the issue for the reason for that is very simple. Commercial journalism in the United States, broadcast and print, for the last 125 years has been dependent by and large upon advertising to pay the majority of its revenues, the vast majority in many cases. And this is true of newspapers as well. And that newspaper advertising and advertising what's for journalism, as we move to an increasingly digital era, advertisers no longer have to use newspapers to reach their target audience. They don't have to buy ads on news media websites. They basically go through vendors and networks like Google and Microsoft and AOL, and they purchase demographics. So the actual website gets a much smaller cut of the advertising dollar than it ever used to, and that's made doing journalism specifically a non-starter. And that's what Gannett's trying to basically go against the tide of what's being seen worldwide about digital journalism.
How big is Gannett?
Gannett's a big company. It owns, I don't have the latest figures, but you might have them from, I think they were announced in the deal with the Journal Sentinel deal, but I think, you know, they've got a ton of newspapers in the United States. They split off their newspapers from their broadcast properties into two companies not too long ago. And but it is a large company, but it's not a giant company. If we talk about Gannett, this isn't like if we had this discussion 15 years ago, I'd be raising the flag about Gannett, and it's like this big evil monopoly like Andrew Carnegie and Jay Gould. They're really small fry compared to the big monopolies of our era, and mm-hmm. they want to become one of the big monopolies of our mm-hmm. era. That's what they're gambling is somehow they can get more or less what I would call a monopoly over journalism. Local journalism in America, so they can have the sort of profits that an Amazon, a Google, or a Microsoft, or an Apple gets. I don't think their chances are great at that, but I think that's what they're playing for.
Well, they're already doing pretty well financially, aren't they?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things about capitalism and the way industries rise and fall, declining industries, if you've got a monopoly in a declining industry, like the only newspaper in a city, even if newspaper revenues are going down, they're still very profitable for a while. You know, if you've got the only newspaper in Milwaukee, you're going to be making money. Now, you've got the only newspaper in Des Moines or Dallas or Cleveland. You're going to make money. You're not going to make as much money. You don't have a lot of growth. Eventually, your market might dry up. But until it does in 10, 15, 20, 25 years, you're just going to rake it in. And they're in the rake it in mode right now.
Mm-hmm. The publisher of the Journal Sentinel said all the news decisions, editorial decisions, community support, everything we do isn't going to change. We make our decisions and run our newsrooms out of Milwaukee. Nowhere else. Has that been the pattern in the other communities where Gannett has papers?
No. Maybe in the public relations releases it is. But, you know, nor should it be or would it be. Why would it rest? If you would invest in a company like Gannett, whose job is to maximize shareholder return, they're hardly going to allow people to make decisions that could undermine shareholder return. So I guess Milwaukee will have control until the conflict comes when they say, well, we need 10 more investigative reporters to cover the community right. And they say, well, that costs too much. And we'll see who has the control then. In American capitalism, usually the person who owns the company has control.
Mm-hmm. When there have been analyses done of what's going to happen here, everybody says, well, the thing that's making money for the paper right now is the Packers and their special editions. Those are why people buy the newspaper. Maybe we won't see elimination of a lot of sports reporters, huh?
That would certainly logically follow that that's the one area you're not going to see any cutback in or less cutbacks in.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that this happened? There was just this transfer with Scripps just a few months ago, and then a few months later we get this. Why is this so rapid?
I think what's happened is that the newspaper industry has been, as I said, decimated in the last 10 years to the point where, when Jeff Bezos, I think it was last year or the year before, bought the Washington Post, the guy who owns Amazon, bought the Washington Post, he paid basically less than 10% of what the Washington Post had been valued a decade earlier. The value of newspaper properties is crumbling because investors don't think there's much of a future there. And I think what's happening now is that a company like Gannett sees the price coming way down at these companies. Imagine what the Journal Sentinel would have fetched in 1998, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Sees the price coming way down, so they're gobbling them up relatively cheap. And their hope is that they can build so much scale that they will have so much market penetration, as they like to say, that they can offer advertisers access to far greater numbers of people, and that this they'll build up enough scale that they can build a viable business model.
And they split their newspapers and local television, as Scripps did as well. Why are people doing that?
You know, I'm not an expert on the Wall Street side of this, but my guess is that for Wall Street stock valuations, that the two industries now are seen are going in different directions altogether. So investors thought they were sort of a confusing mix. So to make it easier for investors, they split them.
Mm-hmm. So just tell me where you think, Professor McChesney, 10 years from now, the kind of news we're going to be getting, where we're going to be getting it, and will we be informed citizens?
No, I don't think we'll be informed citizens. I think the trend line right now is very negative. It has been for a while, and I think the starting point is, you know, the day before Gannett bought Journal Sentinel, it wasn't like we were rocking and rolling and partying and celebrating how much great journalism we had in this country. Quite the contrary. Journalism is in a deep, deep depression as an industry, and it has been in one for years now, and it's not getting better. So I don't think there's anything on the horizon right now to suggest that will change. I think the number of working paid working journalists per capita will continue to decline. We're also seeing a couple of other very disturbing trends that have been taking place for the last 10 or 15 years and that are accelerating. One is that there are so many out-of-work journalists or young people desperate to become journalists. It's putting tremendous downward pressure on wages and working conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So that a media company now can use free labor oftentimes and interns and find volunteer labor or what they call citizen journalists to fill their news hole. It's very profitable for them, but it's not good for journalism when you have volunteer labor and really heavily exploited labor. So that's one of the great trends that's going on. The other is that as companies get more and more desperate to make money, news sites, especially websites, but it's true of traditional old media to the extent you want to make that split anymore. But they find that they're forced to appeal to advertisers, so they have to make concessions to them that compromises the integrity of journalism. This goes, on and on and on. There's something now called native media, which refers to when advertisers basically buy stories to look like stories.
Really?
Yeah. There's a corruption of journalism going on because if you're starting a news site and you're trying to eat food and have dinner and maybe pay your rent and need money, well, the advertisers, commercial interests have a lot of power now. I mean, they've got a lot of choices. And if you aren't willing to dance to their song, they'll say, no, thank you. Then you don't have any money. So there's tremendous commercial pressure to undermine the integrity of journalism. The irony here, of course, Kathleen, is that the reason why we developed professional journalism 100 years ago was precisely to stop that sort of commercial encroachment on the integrity of the news so readers could trust that the journalism was legit. It wasn't paid for under the table by someone who wanted to push their agenda, be it commercial or political.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're in the business of teaching students who may want to get jobs in the whole field. How do you advise them now? There won't be any jobs.
Well, what I do is I advise them, stay with it. We need journalism. This will not be a world worth living in if we don't have journalism. So stay with it. Fight to be a journalist. Secondly, I say, look, the economy is horrible for young people. If you're under the age of 30, this economy is no better than it was in the 1930s for a person getting a job. It's a nightmare. So you might as well try your hardest to do something you want to do and you'll love rather than immediately give up and end up being unemployed way or have a horrible job. But then the final point, and the more serious one, is this. This is a political question. This is a country and all societies have solved this problem of journalism, and we can do it again. It's a political issue that's very solvable. When this country started, not many people could make money doing journalism. If we had just relied on the profit motive, we would have not had a country. We would not have had any sort of news media or press system whatsoever in the first 100 years of American history. And for that reason, we had from the very first day this country started, in fact, even in the colonial era, extensive postal subsidies to basically make the distribution of newspapers virtually free, take that whole cost out of newspaper publishing. And that made it much more much easier for people to publish newspapers and survive and pay their bills. It was a public policy, explicit policy, meant to encourage the spread of a free, uncensored press. And I think we have to think in those terms again. Now that the commercial model is dying, and it is dying, before our eyes, we can almost smell it. Now that it's dying, we've got to come up with ways to create a viable, credible, independent, uncensored journalism, the kind we need so we can have the information so we can be free and govern our lives.
Well, how do we do that?
Well, I think we take a page from the founders. I mean, this is something I've written about a lot. The founders, the genius of the postal subsidies, and they also had other subsidies as well, is that they gave lots of money indirectly to make it possible to have independent media, but they didn't allow the government to control the content. So those subsidies went to abolitionist papers as well as slaveholder papers. It just meant there were tons of newspapers. When Tocqueville came to America in the 1830s, he was astounded at how many newspapers there were all across the country, even in small towns, compared to anywhere else in the world. And he said that it's a measure of a society, the rule in a society is the more newspapers you have, the more equal it is. That became the law he came up with in Democracy in America. And it was public policy that created that. It wasn't market economics. And I think we need to think that way again. What can we do to make it possible so people can be paid, make a living doing journalism, be accountable for it, be in competitive places? And that's the public policy we've got to start working on and taking very, very seriously.
But consider the kinds of debates we've been having. Every year we have these. Some years they're stronger than others to defund public television and radio in this country.
I agree, and I think that would be disastrous. I think that's going in exactly the wrong direction. Although I must say, I think public media are very important, and the principle of public media are important, and you really see it when you get to countries that have made substantial investments in it, Northern Europe, for example. Because mm-hmm. When you go there, even though they have the same crisis in print journalism we do, it's much less noticeable because they still have a substantial public investment in journalism that sort of keeps the tide high and the boats are all floating much better, although they have the same trends we have with digital economics. So I think you're right. Public media is a big part of the picture. But I think we have to go way beyond that. And I think we also have to be really careful and I think have policies that really create a space between politicians and the content. I take that libertarian concern very seriously.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Robert McChesney. He's a professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, co-founder of the Media Reform Network Free Press. He has written extensively about American media, and we are talking this hour about newspapers. Our conversation prompted, of course, because we're in Milwaukee, that Gannett plans to buy Journal Media Group, the parent company of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They now own newspapers in Green Bay, the Fox Valley, other parts of the state. And we're talking about the rapid consolidation of the U.S. newspaper industry, what will happen to news, the dissemination of news. The Journal Sentinel is still the largest paper in the state. What happens when corporate headquarters are not here anymore? Will we suffer a loss of local coverage, of state coverage, of trying to keep those in powerful accountable to us? What happens to news as a result of this? What happens to reporters as a result of this? Our phone number, please feel free to join us because we'd love to hear what your thoughts are about this, you consumers of news, and it means almost everybody listening. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where we like to read your comments as well. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls for Robert McChesney. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And we start with Mark in Mequon. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I'm calling as a concerned consumer of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I understand from other sources that Gannett is a conservative, profit-driven organization, and I'm very concerned about the fact that the Milwaukee Journal will no longer be as the watchdog of the political system here in Wisconsin. My wife and I have been subscribers for many years, and oftentimes I'm embarrassed to say this paper stacks up and we don't get to read it for days. But we continue to subscribe because we support the paper for that purpose, to be the watchdog for us, and has brought up many points, one of which was the bill that was going to make the process in Madison more secret, not public access, and so on and so forth. And it was the journal that brought that forth and I think disrupted that bill, and so it failed to pass. And I'm very concerned that Gannett, being a very conservative paper organization and newspapers, that those things are going to end.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Bob.
Well, yeah, that's Mark has very legitimate concerns. You know, I in this case, I'm less concerned about Gannett's, the CEOs or the major shareholders' political values and biases dictating what will happen in Milwaukee with the Journal Sentinel, as much as I think it's their commercial concerns that are going to be overriding. And the overriding concern, I think there's legitimate reason to think that they're not going to necessarily want to spend a lot of money for journalists if they can figure out a way to spend less money for journalists. That's been the pattern. And I think this would be true of any owner that came in, and it probably would have been true if the Journal Sentinel hadn't been sold. They would have been under similar sort of pressures. This is going on, as I said, nationwide and worldwide. But I think his concern is absolutely the right one. He should have that concern, and that's the issue we've got to solve. We've got to have local journalists who are well-paid, who are accountable, who are competing with other local journalists. They don't have a monopoly to cover their communities, and that means covering people in power and the relationship of people in power with each other so that we as citizens can monitor them and affect change.
It's such a change in the model of the founders of the Milwaukee Journal, isn't it? It was an employee-owned newspaper for years and years and years.
You know, I think Milwaukee has this great tradition, but it's probably a little more, because it was employee-owned, more striking there. But, you know, it was just 50 or, say, 75 years ago, to be really clear. Virtually all newspapers, there were at least usually two newspapers and maybe more in most cities and large cities. Mm-hmm. And they were almost all locally owned. The chains were limited to a handful of companies prior to the 1940s, and they weren't very big. So it was sort of an axiom of the free press tradition in the United States that you had locally owned media. And now the locally owned media usually were owned by really rich people who, you know, weren't necessarily that sympathetic to most people in their community, but at least they lived in the community, so they had to be there and be accountable to the community in one way or another. And I think now we're at the closure of the process where we've gone from that model, which was standard in 1950 in the United States, to the exact opposite. We're at a model where there's basically no local involvement whatsoever in the commercial news media.
Yeah, and not a variety of opinions. The other thing was that it was a two-newspaper town, as so many towns were, and you had the morning paper that was conservative and the journal considered more liberal, and you know, that was good for people to be able to read a variety of viewpoints.
You know, if you really want to get historical, go back 50 years or 60 years before that to Milwaukee in 1900 or 1890, and there were probably seven or eight daily newspapers with even a broader range of opinion. And if you were in Chicago or New York, it would have been 15 or 20 daily newspapers. That was standard in America prior to the 20th century. That's what we considered a free press. I mean, for the first 60 years of the 20th century, the idea that you'd only have two newspapers in a town was considered like living in a totalitarian society. So, you know, we're really whittling down our standards for what a free press is. And now we're at the point where basically a few companies that are trying to make as much money as possible, owning everything and doing whatever they want. You know, and just as long as there's anything at all, we're supposed to be happy.
Yeah. Is Gannett considered editorially a conservative paper?
You know, I think they're considered a paper obsessed with making money. I mean, I don't think they're regarded, you know, they're not like Rupert Murdoch, where, you know, Rupert Murdoch, you know, has his own politics, which he proudly wears. I think they're considered really out to maximize profit. They're certainly, if they have a political agenda, they're pro-business. But I don't think they don't put politics in command, as Chairman Ma used to say. They put economics in command. They're mostly out to make money.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark, for your call. Bob in Amherst Junction. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I think this last discussion about, you know, just exactly why they've stopped doing good journalism is an interesting thing to explore. I still spend what I think is a lot of money to get the New York Times. But I stopped getting Stevens Point Journal and Wisconsin newspapers a decade ago because all it was AP articles. And the most interesting thing I would find myself paging to is the funny pages. So, you know, they, as a business, they chose to stop doing good journalism. And they have, you know, any business has a choice. A business can either add value for a customer and go that route, or they can try to maximize profits and go on the cheap and see how that goes. And I think these local papers have chosen the latter.
Bob McChesney.
He's absolutely right. And there's really two stages to this process. The first stage was the one that took place in the 80s and 90s and accelerated in the 90s. And this was when the whole wave of consolidation really started. Companies like Gannett were gobbling up newspapers all over the country then. And at that time, these companies were really profitable. They still had market dominance. The newspapers were still king for local journalism. And at that point in the 1990s, during the course of the decade, we still saw significant cutbacks in the number of working reporters, even in highly profitable papers. David Simon, who started the show The Wire, who was a famous reporter for the Baltimore Sun prior to doing television shows, you know, he talks about this era in Baltimore when the Sun was just rocking and rolling, making profits, yet they were cutting back in the newsroom because they could get away with it. They had a monopoly, and they knew they wouldn't lose advertisers and they wouldn't lose readers in the near term. And so at that point, I think Bob the caller is correct. That these papers had a choice. They decided to take short-term profits because they have monopoly power and they get away with it, and then they were going to pay the price long-term when their product was whittled out. I think the second part of this, though, and this is the part that makes it sort of tricky, is that now that the Internet has emerged in the last 10 or 12 years and become a dominant force for conveyance of all media and communication, the companies really... The idea of the whole business model doesn't work anymore. And I said this at the top of the show, and it's really worth listeners understanding what I mean by this. The Baltimore Sun, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel made a majority of its money selling advertising to advertisers and still probably does, or it's close still even to this day. Advertisers were the lion's share and certainly a majority of the revenues and the key to profits. And having a local newspaper monopoly or duopoly was a very lucrative industry throughout the 20th century for that reason. But what's happened is that now if you're an advertiser and you're advertising in you want to reach some demographic to sell your product, you don't go to a news medium or a news website and say, I want to buy an ad on your website or I want to buy an ad in your newspaper. You basically go to Microsoft or AOL or Facebook or Google and say, I'm trying to reach all the women I can who are 18 to 24 who might be in the market for an automobile in the next 3 months. And since those companies know everything about you,
right, they do.
They will actually place the ad on wherever website you go to if you fit that demographic. Now, if some of those ads happen to hit the Journal Sentinel website, they will get a small piece of the action. But they won't get all the money like they used to for the ads that used to be purchased just on their newspaper or their website. So newspaper websites in 2003, when they sold ads on their website, they got 100% of the revenue, all, just like they would if they sold an ad in their newspaper. By 2010, it was already down to around 10%. Ooh. 90% was going to networks of one form or another. So that model's dying, which is why newspapers were selling on the cheap. They're basically giving them away. Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post with his spare change drawer.
Yeah, amazing. Do we actually, maybe I'm an anomaly, but I don't even look at the ads on the Internet. Maybe it's just because I am used to newspapers and I would look at those occasionally, but I just don't look at them.
Well, the genius of advertising the Internet is that the traditional ad isn't what's the key there. The key is the targeting people so they get people who are really in the market for products.
I see.
And I suspect if you were in the market for a product and the ad popped up that you're like, here's a trip to Mexico in January. You say, yeah, I was just emailing a friend about it. I was going to go to Mexico. Now here's a discount deal on a trip to Mexico. You might click on that ad.
But then you'd wonder, how in the world do they know I was thinking about going to Mexico? This is weird.
It is weird. And the first time it happens to everyone, they're going, this is really weird. I just, you know, I Google search something, and I'm getting ads about it.
I know. We're going to do a show in the next week because it is weird. So, Bob, where do you get your local news now? if you don't have a newspaper?
Well, yeah, I get news on the internet. And I rely on, you know, like ProPublica and a lot of other websites. But I read the New York Times.
Right.
I pick up a Wall Street Journal. There are still some publications in this country that seem to be making some money. I don't know how or why they're still in business, but they are.
Well, let's ask Bob McChesney. How is the New York Times still in business?
Well, you know, they're still making money, but the interesting thing about the New York Times is that, you know, it is sort of the last newsroom standing at the for national and international news. If, you know, 15 years ago, there were, I don't know the exact number, but there were a good dozen major U.S. news media that had foreign bureaus, lots of them, you know, Boston Globe, Chicago Tribune, L.A. Times, San Francisco Chronicle. Not uncommon for them to have a London bureau or Paris bureau, not to mention a Washington, D.C. bureau, and so a Rome bureau. So, and the networks all had bureaus, too. So if there was an international story, there were maybe 12 different news media that had reporters on the ground or nearby who could cover it. Well, almost all of those disappeared, and a lot of them in the 90s, again, when it was lucrative. But today, they're almost all gone. So the New York Times is sort of the last newsroom standing that covers stuff. It's ironic that it's, you know, it's almost as a control over in national and international news and how it's portrayed in the United States, you know, like Pravda did in the Soviet Union, because there's really no one else covering this stuff oftentimes.
Right. And television, national television, they have, I tend to watch NBC, Richard Engel, and then they have this guy whose name I can't remember who's British, who seems to be everywhere in the world. Well, one day he's in North Korea and the next day he's, you know, in Turkey. It's just, they have, and there are so many stories coming from that part of the world now, and you've got the same person hopping planes.
It's no journalist can do that effectively, and I suspect they'd be the first to tell you in a hotel bar. You know, but there's one person, and you know the way commercial journalism works. Richard Engel becomes a brand, a personality, and he gets well known. He's liked. He has a following. So if he's reporting a story anywhere in that part of the world, they'll be happy with the results commercially. Although I think we'd be much better off if NBC had one reporter in each of the major countries in the region, ideally who knew the local language and the history and everything, and could really then really do reporting.
Let's go. Thanks, Bob, very much for your call. Pete in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Pete.
I'm an old-time journalist. Only it used to be called I was a reporter. Now I'm a journalist. I'm approaching 70 years old. I started out in radio in 1965. My first weekend on the job at a radio station, I covered a coal mine disaster in West Virginia, and I've been going strong ever since. Now, radio abandoned me in the 1990s, and I thought that was probably the end of my career. But in the early 2000s, I started doing freelance work for a locally owned, about that time, locally owned newspaper. It's now owned by Gannett. I've been doing local news coverage, local government news coverage as a freelancer. I'm self-employed, but I'm of the opinion that as long as I'm able to sit up and take nourishment, I'm not going to let local news coverage die completely.
Here's to you, Pete. Are they paying you okay?
I get $50 a story.
$50 a story.
And no, I don't get any expenses, no mileage, none of that.
Ooh.
I'm a widower. And it's just me and the grumpy old cat at home. So I go out and I cover a whole bunch of meetings. I probably do 20 to 25 meetings a month for the paper.
Woo! Professor McChesney.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Pete, for what you're doing. And journalism is a calling, and it takes people who believe in it. I mean, if someone gets into journalism, if they got into just to get rich or famous, they got in the wrong profession, certainly the rich part, at least now. So thank you, Pete, for what you do. Now, but at the same time, what Pete's talking about is, you know, imagine these kids now who go to Marquette or UWM or Madison. And there's, you know, I talk to journalism students all the time, and we have a generation of students who are desperately eager to be great journalists, really talented kids. I see their clips. And this is the world they're going into, Pete's world, $50 a story. And oftentimes it'll be a situation where they have certain types of stories they want covered that they consider worth paying for. And you might think the story is really important. They say, we aren't really interested in that one. So you basically, it's market driven, and it's really like a hiring hall, digital hiring hall for temp workers at low pay. It's no way to, it's no way to have a free press in a healthy society.
No, it's not. And do you generate the stories, or do they call you and say, Pete, we want you?
I generate everything. I take a look at the agendas. I go out and I sit through the meetings, go home and listen to the tape recording so I get the quotes correct and do all my work from my own office at home.
Oh, my. And what happened to radio?
Well, in the 1980s, during the last years of the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration, deregulation of the industry took place. Prior to that time, local broadcasters were required to dedicate 10% of their airtime to local news coverage. With the deregulation in the, I think it was 1989, this occurred. They were no longer required to do any local news coverage. I happened to be working as news director of a radio station in a medium-sized Wisconsin city, and they just shut the whole thing down, the whole news operation.
Ooh.
Yeah, in fact, this is actually an area Bob and Kathleen I've worked on. I've written books on this exact subject because, you know, as Bob knows, you know, in America, when I grew up in the 1960s in Cleveland, Ohio, every radio station, AM station, had a news director, a full-time news director. And you got news, even the pop stations I listened to, the rock stations, you had a five-minute top-of-the-hour newscast. And so if you were just growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, like I did in the 1960s, I knew who the president of France was. I knew who the chancellor of West Germany was. I knew who the head of the AFL-CIO was. I knew all that stuff because it was in the headlines that I got at the top of the hour. So if you were in a city like Cleveland, there were probably 25 full-time radio journalists getting paid a decent salary at that time, maybe more. And Milwaukee, I suspect, was not too different. And those positions are all eliminated. AM radio news basically completely defunct. There are the handful of still 24-hour news stations left in a few cities around the country. But even there, it's mostly been gutted out to just sort of blowhards.
Yeah. Well, carry on, Pete.
I will do that.
I know you will. Thanks. Thanks for calling.
You're quite welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We thought we would find out about the consolidation in the U.S. newspaper industry, this story hitting home, of course, when earlier this month Gannett said they planned to buy Journal Media Group. It looks like it will go through. It's the parent company of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So Gannett now owns newspapers in several places here in the state of Wisconsin, and they're in 106 U.S. markets, so they have a very large audience and a digital audience. I guess the number is more than 100 million visitors. What happens to local news as a result of this? What happens to journalists as a result of this? And what happens to our need to know? Bob McChesney is with us. He is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, co-founder of the Media Reform Network, Free Press, and author of all kinds of books about American media. We have many messages coming in, so we'll read some of those and continue to welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John writes to us on Facebook, Bob, compare the amount of debt service that the average American newspaper had in 1970 with the amount today. When you do this, you will have put your finger on the root cause of the demise of print journalism.
Did he give the numbers? I assume the point is there's much more debt today, so these companies are more desperate.
And, yeah.
But then that begs the question, why is there so much more debt today? You know, I think that the root cause is that the business model doesn't work. If the business model worked, they could pay off debt.
And Judy writes on Facebook, concerned citizens have learned how to get their news from other sources. Nonprofit organizations are big. My issue, she says, is global climate change. I go to many organizations that have regular blogs, Facebook reports, and even long-form reports and white pages. Supporters of these nonprofits are thus paying for topic-specific regional news on specific issues. It's not the New York Times, but it's something.
It is something, and sometimes there's some great work that comes out of groups like that. For example, the Madison Group the Center for Media and Democracy did the ALEC series a few years ago that won national journalism awards, even though they're not a news medium. And so, yeah, I think there can be environmental groups and groups of other issues that can do the reporting that traditional news media no longer do or have the resources to do. And I think that's fine, but that begs begs one question and it leads to a second one. The question it begs is that, you know, that still requires money. Those groups, you know, they have to pay people to do that labor. So you still got the fundamental material question: how do you pay for that? How do you fund that? And then the second issue is that sounds well and good, but you know, how accountable is that? So if you're reading a piece on whatever the subject is, the person who's paying for it is probably paying for a particular viewpoint, paying for their agenda, and they might not want it to be well known what that agenda is. It leads to all sorts of murky questions. There's a reason why it's nice to have a press system where the press's job is just to report, and it, you know, it's above board, and it's not supposed to be involved in other facets like having an edge on an issue.
John in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, John.
I've been able to work with Bob Wills, the old editor of the Journal of Sentinel, the last few weeks and months. And he's about 89 now, and he's still trying to write. And it's incredible to see his work ethic every day. I'm just wondering if you see, like, the modern young kids still working just as hard. He only sleeps about 6 hours a day still because, one, he needs to get around, but he also just always coming up with stories, always looking for the story and everything around him. So curious what your thoughts are on that and a new generation of reporters coming up.
Well, you know, I'm a college professor, and I give lots of talks around the country. I'm as critical of students at times, as frustrated as a lot of professors are. You know, you have to cut back in the readings, and you get grumpy about how harder it was in your day. But I've got to say, when I go to these journalism schools, and we talked about this earlier in the program, I am struck with the commitment these kids who want to do journalism have and how hard they're willing to work and how they have to work at this point. And, you know, just yesterday, for example, I was at a local community station in Madison, WRT, which is an hour-long locally produced news show by volunteers. And it's almost all people in their 20s. I think there's a couple of paid staffers who help out and participate in it. But many of them are connected to the UW. They're journalism students there. And I was in the newsroom, and I swear to God, you would have thought it was like 1927 or something. It was people flying. It was just like the old days. Oh. You go into most newsrooms today, you know, Kathleen, like it smells like formaldehyde. There's hardly anyone there. There's no energy. There's a generation that's dying to do journalism. We've got to somehow create a system so they can.
Yeah, I'm with you. John, thanks. Harry in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Harry.
Hi. I'm just calling. I worked at the Green Bay Press-Gazette for 37 years. Obviously, I'm retired now, but I worked there when it was both family-owned and corporate-owned, being Gannett-owned. And it'll take about 6 months, and the Gannett imprint will be thrown at the Journal Sentinel, I can assure you of that.
What's the imprint?
Downhill. none of us, Al Newhart was in the editorial office when the sale was announced, and he said, from now on, we're going to have fun. Well, we didn't have fun one day after that. I don't think any of us enjoyed, the decisions are being made in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And not in the editorial rooms of the Green Bay Press-Gazette. And I think that's the critical problem there because, you know, what's good in Green Bay is not necessarily good in Detroit or St. Cloud or wherever they may own a paper.
Mm-hmm. Bob.
Well, yeah, I think that my experience from traveling around the country and talking to lots of people like Harry, lots of people who are journalists and have been journalists and have had long careers is I've yet to meet one, frankly, who said, boy, you know, it really sucked back in the 70s and 80s, but thank God the company X, be it Gannett or someone else, came in and bought us up and things really got better. We're doing much better journalism and we've really got strong support from corporate headquarters to really get out there and kick butt. Yeah. Yet to hear one reporter, not a single one has ever told me that.
So
Harry, they're bottom line oriented. That's the whole thing.
Right.
Exactly.
So what happened to local news coverage?
Well, it disappeared.
Really?
Right now, I was a business editor for 20 years, and, you hardly find any news in the paper today. On the front page, you'll have a large picture and two stories, and that's it. And, you know, I go to meetings in town, I say, where's the reporter? And there's nobody there. I can give you an example. One of our editors is now on the Green Bay School Board, and he said they never see a reporter at the school board meeting. That's one of our biggest tax yes. organizations in the whole city.
Well, you have to have people covering that, don't you, in some capacity, Professor McChesney? That's part of a democracy.
It absolutely is, and there's no doubt that that is exactly why the First Amendment's there, what the framers were thinking about. I mean, I've written about it, I've done the research, and in fact, in the Supreme Court decisions, we've had about six or seven major First Amendment Supreme Court decisions that basically are about what does freedom of the press mean in America, and every single one is predicated on the idea that it's the first job of the government to make sure there's a credible, strong, independent press system that monitors the government. It's the Fourth
right.
Estate.
Yes.
The entire system doesn't work unless you have that. In fact, John, who was it? Potter Stewart, the great Supreme Court justice from the post-war era, who wrote some of the really important decisions, like in the Pentagon Papers case, gave a famous speech at Yale Law School in 1974, and he said the First Amendment's Freedom of the Press Clause is a structural provision of the Constitution mandating the creation of an independent free press. And I think that's absolutely right.
Mm. Thank you so much, Harry, for your call. Bob in Minocqua. Hi.
Hi. I want to bring up a slightly different subject, which is radio. I listen to the BBC at night on your stations, and NPR doesn't begin to compare to what the BBC covers. They have personnel virtually in every country in the world, and they know what's going on. Insofar as local coverage, I grant you that's not local, but I couldn't live without it. I wake up at night and I turn on BBC and I find out more listening to that from all over the world than I do from anything local or within the United States. Any comments?
How do they do it, Bob?
Well, there's actually not a real secret about that. If you look at the amount that Britain pays per capita to support the BBC, or that Denmark pays, or Norway, or Sweden, or Finland pays per capita, or Germany, that's just a big country, pays per capita to support their public broadcasting. If we paid the same amount per capita in the United States, if NPR and PBS and community radio, all of them together, got the same federal subsidy that those countries get per capita, our budget for public broadcasting, instead of being, was it $400 million, I think, something like that, would be more along the lines of $20
billion.
So imagine if we had $20 billion funding three or four newsrooms in every community with different people controlling it, NPR, PBS, community, local. That's what they've got in those countries. Those are sort of resources they're playing with. And when you've got those sort of resources and you've got institutional power so politicians are scared of you, you can do some great work. And that's what we lack. That's what they have.
Yeah. Chris called and she's wondering if what this will mean for alternative weekly newspapers like the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. Will it need to step up its coverage, or perhaps it can somehow take advantage of the Gannett purchase?
Well, I think, you know, it'll if the pattern holds, the one that we've been talking about, there's going to be a little more stories for them to cover that no one else will be in the room when they try to cover it. So there's room to operate. The question they're going to face is there going to be money to pay their bills? Or are they going to have to rely on volunteer labor? I mean, they still have that fundamental material question, which it gets back to. But there's certainly, this is a golden age for alternative media if you can somehow find someone to pay the bills.
Right. Well, I keep thinking about Harry, I think his name was, from Green, or no, one of the earlier callers, it wasn't Harry, who was talking about he's still at it at the age of 70, $50 a story. If that's the model for your students now, heaven help us.
Yeah, it's just not going to work. And it gets to a broader story. We should do a show on Kathleen later. What's happened to the labor market for young people in this country? Which
sure,
I isn't
happy
really,
to do that.
Isn't really getting talked about a lot, but I mean,
right.
It is a depression situation for people in their 20s today, and there's no signs in the horizons to get better, and so they can get away with this. I mean, because what other choices do kids have, young people have? But it's no solution. I mean, look at it this way. Would you get on an airplane if the pilots were being paid $50 for a transatlantic flight and they were sort of signed up at a hiring hall and you didn't even know if they had any skills? And of course not.
No.
Why are we trusting our free press to a system so absurd?
Well, let's ponder that question before we meet again. Thank you, Bob.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Bob McChesney, our guest this hour. He is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. co-founder of the Media Reform Network Free Press and has written widely on all kinds of issues related to media. And that would be a good show, What's Happened to the Labor Market for Young People. We'll hold him to that and do a show in, you know, the not-too-distant future on that very subject. All right. Thanks very much to K.P. Whaley for production. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, which probably pretty soon there will no longer be a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. That's kind of sad, isn't it? It really is. It's kind of sad. Very sad. Thanks for listening.